All right, a few announcements before we begin. I think everybody would have gotten the email, but yes, I've had blood clots for 2 months that the doctor didn't bother with. But hopefully that's being taken care of. I got a clot buster medicine, so. And I am convinced that probably around 2 months ago that probably I had a pulmonary embolism because one of them probably got loose because I was having real trouble breathing one night, but I kind of fell back asleep, and so it didn't seem to be too bad. So, at any rate, I've survived it. And then, of course, it worked out well this week. I always feel bad if I have to cancel class because of me. I don't necessarily, if we have to cancel because weather is so bad, people are life-threatening weather, I don't care about that. I don't care about canceling for vacations. But as it turned out, several people in the congregation had been exposed to COVID. Three of them have it, and it was a good thing we didn't have class anyway, probably, because I don't know that they would have known about their symptoms at that time. So, at any rate, that worked out okay. I figure it was, you know, God's way, His providential guidance and all that, where I felt bad about it, but we'll do what we can, and I may have to. The prognosis is probably apparently pretty good, but he didn't seem concerned. But then again, he didn't seem concerned when I had clots, so who knows. But I contacted him later and said, well, what about exercise? I mean, can I continue to do aerobic exercise and stuff? No exercise for 2 weeks, he says. I go online, every place I look said exercise is fine. So I'm not sure how good a doctor he is, but as we know, they are practicing, and they practice on us, and we're the guinea pigs at some level. So just pray that God will work it out and protect me and do all those things that He's done all these years. Because I can now name probably a half dozen or a dozen times I should have been dead. And some of them were before I was a believer, but many of them have been after. So I'm convinced God keeps those alive who are positive, who want to do the right things and grow up and still grow up. And although it's a little daunting when you consider that our standard for growth is perfection, and knowing that we'll never attain to perfection in this life, that's not going to happen. But yeah, we strive to be like Jesus. It isn't just a matter of learning doctrine. It's translating this into your personal relationship with the Lord, which I understand can be a little subjective, but doctrine sets the parameters for this. Tells us what sort of things the Lord wants, doesn't want, gives us, provides us guidance and direction and all that. Instruction in the godliness code. All right, well, I tried to touch base with Pete to see how he's doing, but he was not doing well, so you may want to pray for him. I'm going to run by after class and check on him. But the fact that he's not answering his phone is a little concerning, so we'll find out, I guess. All right, well, if none of that got you out of fellowship, or it did, now would be the time to rebound. Father, I'm sorry that I got angry and wanted to kill Ron's doctor. Well, believe me, I kind of have been there, so I've dealt with that sin. I kind of have an idea. I didn't really want to kill him, but the fact that they'll never take credit for their mistakes, they'll never own up to them, that's what's really disturbing, that this could have been potentially deadly. All right, well, let's make sure we're in fellowship and let's continue on here. Now let's start looking at, and some of this information I recognize, as one person said, well, it's a little dry. I wish I could just make everything fun and happy for you all the time. But unfortunately, number one, it's not my job. And number two, it's not really possible. Some information is more readily digested and germane to a Western audience that we have today. But the reality is this is background information on why the Pharisees were the way they were. Because that's what we got coming up here in our next verse in chapter 5. We're going to get into this matter of the Pharisees. And the rest of it's pretty straightforward. Circumcised the eighth day, everybody knows what that means. The nation of Israel, everybody knows what that means. Tribe of Benjamin, kind of a respected tribe among the Israelites at certain points. A Hebrew of Hebrew parents. Well, that means I'm a pure-blooded Hebrew. There were a lot of people out there, no doubt, like Timothy, son of a Greek and a Gentile and a Jew. As to the law, a Pharisee. And that's what we'll look at, is where these Pharisees came from, why Paul thinks kind of some ways the way he does, and why, that as far as he knew, he was serving God and advancing God's plan through his Pharisaical actions. I mean, he was a complete unbeliever, tormenting, torturing, and imprisoning believers, and was convinced he was in the will of God. So once a person's to that point, there's not... Well, I don't think anybody other than the Lord could have gotten through to him. And the Lord, of course, did on the Damascus Road there. All right, well, point one, when one considers the characteristics and doctrines of the Pharisees, he should recognize that information regarding these comes from three primary sources. Now, some are better than others. The first is the New Testament. Obviously, that's a great primary source for us because we recognize it under inspiration. That this isn't just another book, another set of information regarding the Pharisees. This is the Pharisees as they dealt with and interacted with Jesus, and the Pharisees as seen from the divine viewpoint by the way they interacted with the Son of God. By the way they interacted with their own Messiah, although they did not acknowledge him to be such. Well, the first is the New Testament. And that one, obviously, we feel is, well, we know, is 100% reliable. We can trust it. The writings of Josephus, those are pretty good. But Josephus also tended to cast things in the best Jewish light. That was a part of the way he wrote. That he wasn't necessarily always intellectually honest. He could exaggerate, undersell stuff, numbers of things. So we recognize that with any secular historian, they may have a bias. They may be in favor of something, and it may affect their way they write and their viewpoint. So the third, of course, of the information is the Jewish Talmud. This is a collection of the Jewish writings, the Mishnah, and all of that that are put together. These really weren't collected until much later, 300-500 AD. So these writings are later, but did these writings of which they're drawn exist during the time of Paul? Oh, I'm sure they did. I think they were documents that would document what they believed. So that one's the least reliable of them, but we will look at some of what it says. So the primary source the believer should consult, of course, is the New Testament, particularly the Gospels and the Book of Acts. In that regard, this religious group is only mentioned one time outside the Gospels and Book of Acts, and that's our verse coming up. That's why we're doing this now. But this is the only time they're mentioned in any of the epistles at all. So in that regard, they're mentioned only once here. And it seems that the writers of the New Testament generally recognized that the character and teachings of the Pharisees were already something with which their readers were quite familiar. The very Jewish source of the church coming out of Jerusalem there in the beginning and largely being confined to Judea. Well, they would have been certainly aware of the Pharisees and the way they worked, the way they operated, what they believed, and all of this. They interacted with them. They certainly would have. The readers, to some extent, I don't think, like the Gentile readers in Philippi, why does Paul use such strong language when describing these people? Not just the Pharisees, but the Judaizers in general, of which I believe the Pharisees would have been the ringleaders in that. Because they're the ones that are singled out in Acts 15. Matter of fact, if you look there in Acts 15, the Judaizers are kind of identified with the Pharisees in some way. Acts 15. 5. But some of the sect of the Pharisees who had stood up say, it is necessary to circumcise them and to direct them to observe the law of Moses. And I think that the Pharisees themselves probably formed the core, not that there weren't other types of Judaizers, but they were the core of the hardcore Judaizers. They were the ones that their theology affected this as much as anybody. And then see, while they are mentioned some 95 times in the Gospels and Acts, the authors only seem to emphasize the matters in which they exhibited antagonism toward the Lord or towards those who followed him. We can just do a quick survey here through Matthew, and this isn't all of them, but Matthew chapter 9. And you can always do a concordance search. If you got a Strong's concordance, or you can probably get them online nowadays and find out where all the usages are. You can't buy Bible Works anymore. They're out of business, so too bad on there. I suppose you could do all that in Logos, although I've had to download it and use it. I've not used the exegetical part of it because I don't have to. But Matthew 9:11 here, when the Pharisees saw this, they said to the disciples, and this is that Jesus, verse 10, was reclining at the table in the house. And behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. See, these might be positive seekers, but the Pharisees don't see it that way. The Pharisees believe that these people, these are called Amharites, the people of the land. And the Amharites were, as they saw it, people who didn't pay enough attention to the law, who weren't fastidious enough, who didn't observe all the rituals, and particularly not the traditions of the elders. And that they believed that the people of the land were cursed because they didn't know the law. And so they looked down on them. And anybody that came out of that system, and tax collectors, of course, and sinners, has the idea here of people who are unclean according to their standards, not to be engaged with, and were really down at the bottom of the pole on the pecking order. They believed that tax collectors were Roman sellouts. And in some ways they could have been, but that's just the way they saw it. So when they saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why is your teacher eating with tax collectors and sinners?" And when Jesus heard this, he said, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick." And go and learn what this means. "I desire compassion and not sacrifice." But they don't have any compassion on people that aren't as good as them. This is one of the things I have observed over the years in the, quote, doctrinal movement, although it's hardly a doctrinal movement, is that there's a tendency towards Phariseeism, towards looking down on people because they don't have it all together like we do. They're just lacking understanding and all of that. And we have to avoid that mentality. As believers, that's not appropriate. You may have more doctrine than your next... God, I hope you do. Than your next door neighbor. You may have more doctrine than a lot of people. But we want to model it in a winsome way. In a way that wins people and doesn't alienate them. One of the things that will stand out in this when we see it is that the Pharisees very much alienated people. Because of their mentality and their attitude. They looked like this all the time. You all are pathetic and you know it. Every one of you. Every last one. That would be the Pharisees. They look down their nose at everybody. And we have to recognize, while people are unbelievers, and they may be negative, and they may be hostile and all of that, our job isn't to hate them. It isn't to look down on them. It is, if we ever have opportunity, to witness to them. Now, they may not respond, and probably won't. And you may never even have the opportunity. But, you know, we don't want to have the attitude of, this is all... And see, the Pharisees were one of the ones that they said, Jesus said, don't assume that those people on whom the Tower of Siloam fell were more evil than other men. And no doubt that was one of the things the Pharisees immediately thought. Look, God killed those people. Number one, be real careful about making judgments about why God's doing stuff. I mean, unless you absolutely know. Unless you're absolutely clear on it. You may have some idea why God's doing it. And you may be right. But caution is in view when you start attributing motive to God. That's where we have to really watch it. And no doubt they said, well, yeah, those people were worse. That's why the tower fell on them. Well, by that standard, well, the Ukrainians are horrible because Russia's attacking them. So we should hate the Ukrainians. And I'm being facetious, of course, but you have compassion, but what is their theology and what is their relationship with God? It's not a good one. They are Eastern Orthodox, largely. And so their idea, when it says, I read this deal, Ukraine was like, 80 or 90% Christian. I went and started looking at the statistics. If they go to church anywhere and identify with any kind of religion, they're Christian. Well, that's not it. Then you go and you find out 5% or less are actually Protestant. All the rest of them are offshoots of the great whore, the Catholic Church. That's their theology. And so even if their theology is bad, I don't presume, they're under attack because God hates them. No, it could be undeserved suffering, could be a lot of stuff. But I'm also not going to get involved in it, and I don't feel like it's our job as America to go save Ukraine either. That's not our job. We are constantly involved in crap that's halfway around the world that doesn't really influence us or impact us. And sending billions and billions of dollars. I guarantee you, the weaponry people love this. War is big business, folks. And there's a lot of money. There's plenty of money to be made supplying the army with the tools of the trade. So put down your book and pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. That's a song by Country Joe and the Fish. It's about the Vietnam War and how expensive it was and what it cost and then the lives that it lost. And by the way, it wasn't ever a war because we never declared war on them. We just went over there and killed them in the name of democracy. We're making them safe for God. Well, we didn't, unfortunately. So again, we recognize that people who are not believers, and even negative believers, they may need our compassion. And this is the kind of verse, though, that, see, now this is my Southern Baptist Fundy pastor used to say, well, see, the church is a hospital for sinners. It's not a home for saints. The church is the saints, dummy. I didn't know this at the time. It all sounds good on the surface when you hear that. Because in order to sell his book, Real Evangelism, you had to stress evangelism. And we're both out dragging people in. That's all we're about here at the Southern Baptist. We just want to get them all saved. Well, once we get them saved, what are we going to do with them? We don't have any way to teach them or grow them. That's what's sad. And that was why I got out of there ultimately. Well, again, they're mentioned 95 times. So here you see Acts 9:11, also 9:34. The Pharisees were saved. He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. In other words, Jesus is in league with Satan, and that's the only reason he's successful. That he is actually not of God at all. In fact, he's of the devil. And you people are too dumb to know this. And that, of course, that's the Pharisees. We're here to save you, like the government. We're here to protect you. 12:2. And again, I just skim through these and just pick some out. This was when the disciples were hungry and they were picking the grains, heads of grain to eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do not do what is not lawful on a Sabbath." And he said, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry? He and his companions, how they entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, or for those with him, but for the priests alone? Or have you not read the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent?" So you're saying people can't pick grain to eat it on the Sabbath. Well, you can't go eat bread then either. It's made from grain. And so therefore, but I say to you, something greater than the temple is here. And again, how many times does he tell them this? "I desire compassion, not sacrifice." You're busy condemning everything you don't agree with. This is what I've seen this in doctrinal people too. And even when they're right, it can become dangerous of condemning things that we don't agree with. They may not be healthy, they may not be right, but we still have to, we have to maintain the line. But on the other hand, we don't want to be more critical than we have to be. We want to maintain a line that's appropriate to the doctrine we know, that grants compassion to people and hopes the best for them, but recognizes things that are wrong and evil and all of this as well. Also, verse 14. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as to how they might destroy him. So murder conspiracy was on the table early on with these people. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians. The Pharisees appear to be, however, the ringleaders in all of this. The Sadducees may want it, and I believe that they do, because Jesus was a threat to them as well. But who actually goes out and kind of does the work and let's make a plan? The Pharisees are the first ones we're told about. And I believe if you look in the, well, let's go ahead and finish this up, but 15:1. Let's see, where are we at here? Matthew 15:1. Then some of the Pharisees and the scribes. The scribes are the lawyers. That's, I think Shakespeare had that right. How do we start? Kill all the lawyers. We probably can't do that. We're not advocating for that, by the way. That's a joke. Since people listen online, I know they can't see smiles and body language. So some Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." Again, not out of sanitation, not out of good hygiene, but because they're not following the rules of the elders, damn it. And the elders know what they're doing, and they've made the rules, and we trust them, even though they're not biblical. Well, they weren't biblical, unfortunately. And so he calls them out on it. Also, 16:1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came up testing Jesus. They get more bold as they get towards the end here too. They become more aggressive as they get towards the end of Jesus' public ministry. Testing Jesus, and they ask him to show them a sign from heaven. And he replied to them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, you say there will be a storm today, for the sky is red." That was the old saying, you know, red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in the morning, sailor, take warning. Don't go out if it's red sky in the morning on the Gulf. It may be your last trip. And he said, you know how to discern the appearance of the sky. You're pretty good at this. But you cannot discern the signs of the times. And so they're spiritually darkened. Of course, they reject the truth when they see it. They come up against Jesus and they continue to reject him. And I can't remember where it was. I know it was in Mark, but there was a verse in there where it said the Pharisees and the Herodians went out and conspired against him. So the other two sources, again, of information regarding the Pharisees come from Josephus, who lived from about 37 to 100 AD, and from the Jewish Talmud. The evidence of Josephus, who claims to have lived according to the sect of the Pharisees, and I put the footnote in there, so if you ever want to check out his work, if you have, they're online, you can read them if you choose to. Let's see, what do we got here? Josephus, Life of Flavius Josephus 1:12. What he actually says here is, "I continued with him 3 years, and so when I had accomplished my desires, I returned back to the city, now being 19 years old, and began to conduct myself according to the rules of the sect of the Pharisees, which is of kin to the sect of the Stoics, as the Greeks call them." So he viewed the Pharisees to some extent. Now, I know he knows they're a religious group, but the Stoics were not, quote, a religious group. They were just philosophers. And in some ways, I think Josephus sees the Pharisees as philosophers of sorts. They may be more enlightened than other people, other Jews, but they may not, again, is the thing we know. Lived to the Pharisees is made somewhat less valuable by the fact that he seems to have modified the accounts of his people in order to appeal to his Roman audience. He's writing a history of the Jews for Romans, though. He's trying to appeal to a Roman audience. So he refers to the Pharisees as a philosophic sect, somewhat like the Stoics, and not an active political party. He never references their messianic hope. He addresses these things, and that's actually in his previous verse, 1:10. So when I was about 16 years old, I had a mind. You'll only be able to see this up here. I don't have the stuff in there. It's on the overhead here. The several sects that were among us. These sects are three. The first is that of the Pharisees. The second, that of the Sadducees, and the third, that of the Essenes, as we have frequently told you. Now, the Essenes were a splinter-off group of Jews who were eschatological separatists. They believed they were living in the last days. They believed Messiah was going to show up and save them. They believed that Judaism was corrupt, and so they largely separated themselves from Judaism. They lived in cloistered communities out in the middle of the desert. That's where the caves of Qumran contain where this stuff came from, was probably from the sect of the Essenes. So they were Jewish, had access to all the Jewish writings and all of that. And they had their own deal because they were a religious sect. They came up with their deal called the Manual of Discipline. Now, that's what we're going to get. A manual of discipline for you to live by. And they dealt with this thing in terms of eschatology a lot. They had this conflict, the sons of light and the sons of darkness, which recognizes the angelic conflict in the world and its impact on men. But he sees these as three sects. He doesn't really talk about them in terms of, quote, their religious aspect or even their political aspect. He does seem to see them more as philosophical views. So the Talmud, the teachings of Rabbinic Judaism, consist of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the oral Torah that was compiled about 150 to 200 AD. Now, was this information available long before that? Oh, absolutely. They had a great historic oral tradition, the Jews did. And in fact, that's how Moses got, obviously God could have provided revelation. But Moses, much of his knowledge came from the historical tradition that was passed down from generation to generation. There were believers in each generation that grew up and that passed on the doctrinal teachings that they had learned. And they had a good oral tradition. And so Moses used that a lot to compile his work. And this also included the Gemara. The teaching compiled about 500 to 600 AD, obviously much later, makes it much less valuable, which were both written by the descendants of the Pharisees. Now, the good thing is, what we do know about the authors of these works is that they were Pharisaical in nature, that they came from that sort of religious tradition. However, the Gemara, from which a great deal of information is derived, was compiled so much later that it lessens the value of some of the evidence presented by the Talmud. And so the Mishnah provides a virtual encyclopedia of the legalism of the Pharisees, which instructs the reader with an incredible amount of detail concerning every area of conduct. And I won't bore you with all, but as you know, Jesus rebuked them for their detailed instructions on how to please God. You tithe mint and dill and cumin. You go home and you look at your mint plant, if you got any, or your dill. And they're not very big. And they would meticulously go out and get 10% of it and present it to the Lord. Is God that anxious about this? That he needed that? And he made fun of him. He said, you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but you avoid the weightier matters of the law, justice and compassion and integrity. You don't have any of these. So, again, the Mishnah is good in that it is greatly detailed. And really, when you understand the Pharisees, you can almost tell it came from the mind of a Pharisee. Because they were into this infinite, tedious, infinite detail, which doesn't advance people. Some detail is good. Some of it's not necessary. But this is a good background thing to know in general when you read about these people. One, where did the Pharisees even come from? How did they get on the historical scene? Then we'll deal with all that here. Well, nevertheless, the important information, the information that is available from this variety of sources allows the student of the Bible to have a fairly accurate and consistent understanding of the Pharisees. Of course, you've got to be a student of the Bible, too. That's really where most of our information is drawn from, but we will cite other sources when they're germane, with the recognition they're not inspired. Well, historical information, events that led to the formation of the Pharisees. This goes back now, following the death of Alexander the Great. This was about 323 B.C. His kingdom was divided into four parts. And a matter of fact, I should have put that in there, but if you look in Daniel, the book of Daniel, in the Old Testament, there's a prophecy with respect to this. And you begin in Daniel chapter 8 with historical information that Daniel records. And you have various things in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, and I don't think it's online. The notes may be to it. I would probably want to read them. I might be embarrassed now, but hopefully not too badly. But Daniel will alternate between prophetic information, historical information, what was happening at that time, and that's how the book begins, with the deportation of the Jews to Babylon. That's where it all picks up, under Nebuchadnezzar. This goes back, obviously, some way to around 600 B.C. is when we're looking at the time of Nebuchadnezzar and his when he conquered Jerusalem. So you have that historical information, then you have prophetic information, and then you actually have stuff that was happened, events. Like Daniel 2 tells about, or Daniel 1 there tells about this event where they're brought to Babylon and all that. And then Daniel 6, I believe it is, tells the story about Daniel in the lion's den. That's kind of an important event in his life. Here in Daniel chapter 8, he looks up, he sees this vision. And now I lifted my eyes in verse 3, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in the front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. Well, historically, this is a prophecy regarding the Medo-Persian Empire. It started under the Medes, who were less notable than the Persians. And that's not why they're the shorter horn. But horns symbolize power in the prophetic word. That these are world powers here in this case. And the Medes, of course, arose historically first, and the Persians followed along behind them and consolidated the kingdom. And I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward. And no other beasts could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. And if you saw that movie, The 300, that's a historical movie about the attack of the Persians there on the Greeks and Spartans. And so Persia had world domination as its goal. Now, what nation hasn't? When you look back through human history, it is a wreckage, strewn with the wreckages of nations that wanted to dominate the world. And Putin's going to be one of them too. Only he's going to get to dominate, I think, a fair part of it before he's over. He's not going to ever capture the whole world. But if he takes Ukraine, which I suspect that's a matter of time, and all that, then destroys the West, he's going to be the big boy on the block for a little bit. But of course, then now you got the Antichrist popping up. They're going to create problems for it. So it won't all be fun and games for it. So I saw him running north, and nobody could stand before his power. And the Persian Empire at its zenith was not resistible. They ran over everybody. They just by sheer force of numbers, they had they outnumbered almost everybody. And while I was observing, behold, a male goat coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. This is designed to symbolize, first, the male goat is a reference to Greece. Greece, but with a specific focus on Alexander the Great, the most notable leader of Greece. Now, Philip of Macedon, his father, had done some work in trying to consolidate the Greek city-states. They had recognized that world powers like the Medes and the Persians there were going to create problems if they did not withstand them. And they could never withstand them while they were fractured. And so they wanted to unify Greece. And Philip of Macedon did a lot towards this. But Alexander came along and did it in earnest. And got Greece into a position and a mindset of world conquest. And the fact that he moved so fast over the earth, this is a reference likely to the fact that he conquered the entire known world in a period of less than 10 years. Now, I don't know what you think is impressive, but that is. And the people he conquered, the Medes and the Persians, were no easy feat. But he was a more skilled. He had a prophecy, of course, that he was going destined to rule the world. And he may be, but not in his lifetime, not in his human lifetime. He didn't. He largely conquered a bunch of it. His kingdom extended from Greece all the way over into Pakistan and India. But he met his match there because nobody has ever won a war in Afghanistan. Neither did he. That's about the area, that's about as far as he got. And while I was observing, of course, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Well, who would be that conspicuous horn? The most notable Greek leader of antiquity. Well, it's Alexander the Great. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and he rushed at him in his mighty wrath. The Greeks, by the way, hated the Persians. This was not just military conquest and we want to rule the world. They hated them. And it's easier to fight your enemies when you really, really hate them. And you really want them dead. That gives you real added motivation. And I saw him, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, broke the power of Medo-Persia. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him. And there was none to rescue the ram from his power. And the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. You talk about an ego. This guy had it in spades. And he catered to his own ego. He believed from the oracle there at Delphi, or maybe it was the one at Pythias, I can't remember, but he'd had an oracle tell him he was destined to rule the world and he was going to be the world conqueror, and that he was the Son of God. And so he believed in his own divinity, it would appear. Came to believe in it, whether he believed in it or not, it's hard to tell because a lot of this died with him. And we still don't even know why he died or where he's at. No grave for him till yet. When one of them, he magnified himself, and as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. No sooner had Alexander conquered the world than he died. It's just almost ironic that somebody could be that successful, that fast, and at a relatively young age. Alexander was not an old man. It didn't take him forever to do all this. And the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. And this refers to the division of the empire of Alexander among his four notable generals. You had Ptolemy, Cassander, Licinius, and who was the fourth one? Seleucid. And so these four generals essentially divided up his territory. The Ptolemies took the southern part. They ended up mostly in Egypt. Seleucus and all of that, Seleucus, they were up there in around Israel and Syria to the north. Some of them, I can't remember who was to the west towards Greece. I think maybe that was Cassander. But at any rate, the ones we're interested actually are going to be Seleucus. Because this is where this forms the backdrop of why the Pharisees came into existence in the first place. So following the death, again, his empire was divided as four of his generals fought for supremacy. Palestine was sandwiched between two of the rivals, Seleucus and Ptolemy. For the next 125 years, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies battled for control over the land of Israel. And Alexander died in 323, that takes us right down to 198. You take off 125 years, and there you are. The former finally achieved victory. In 198 AD, when Antiochus III defeated the Egyptians and incorporated Judea into his empire. And initially, he continued to allow the Jews autonomy. But after a significant defeat at the hands of the Romans, Rome was starting to be a force, or beginning to be recognized that they could be problematic. As a force by this time, and this is around 175 roughly or so AD, 190, somewhere in that vicinity. Rome is not what it's about to become, but Rome is going to be a force by the time of Julius Caesar and all that in 46 AD. And we're not, that, you know, you're 140 years or so from that. But they were going to ultimately become a force as we know. He began a program of Hellenization. That threatened to force the Jews to abandon their monotheism for the polytheism of the Greeks. Now, if you're not familiar with Hellenization, this is actually what the word Hellene means, Greek. And the Hellenistic culture was the culture of Alexander, the Greek culture. And it was viewed by many in antiquity and even still today as one of the greatest cultures. Many of the things that we have in our culture and other cultures came from the Greek culture. And so it was recognized widely, but for the Greeks, it was the only culture. It wasn't just a good one or one of many choices. It was the only way to live. And so essentially what they did was they came in and they forced you to be a Greek. And that means you had to accept the Greek gods, you had to do what the Greeks did, you had to abide by their customs and all of that. You had to jettison your religious beliefs, if you believed in Yahweh, forget it. They weren't interested in that. And in some cases, many of these conquerors, not the Seleucids particularly, but historically, many conquerors would allow nations and all that, the conquered people, to retain their autonomy. And they could worship under their religion and do their stuff. As long as they paid tribute and the taxes and all of that, they didn't care what they did. And Rome largely adopted that kind of live and let live attitude. As long as you weren't into some weird religion where you were chopping up people and feeding them to people and doing all kinds of weird stuff that they couldn't see as being actually a religion, they let the Jews engage in their religion and never bothered them to speak of. Now, the Jews created problems and all that, but that wasn't really the Romans' fault. So basically, you have to become a polytheist. They had, obviously, in the games and all of that, you exercised in the nude. The gymnasium was a nude place. So there was no shame, public shame in nudity in that regard. And and again, most of the time, it seems they wouldn't enforce this. Well, the Seleucids decided they were going to. That we're going to save the world. We're going to save these Jews from their stupid backward ways. We're here to help. Now, translated, get out of our way. We're going to run roughshod over you. Well, Antiochus backed down in the face of some Jewish opposition to his attempt to introduce idols into their temple. That was another thing. They would attempt to blaspheme their temples and all of that. They didn't recognize, when they got militant about this, they didn't recognize their religious traditions. They didn't see their temple as any more holy than any other temple, so they could go into that temple anytime they felt like it. Well, he tried to introduce idols into their temple. However, his son, Antiochus IV, who inherited the throne in 176 BC, resumed his father's original policy of Hellenization without allowing for an exception for the Jews. And a brief Jewish rebellion only served to confirm his views and led him to outlaw the central tenets of Judaism, such as Sabbath observance and circumcision. This is enforced Hellenism now. You can't circumcise your children. One of the things I always hear, and you always hear it from the liberals, you can't legislate morality. That's all laws are. The whole thing is designed to legislate morality, whatever they perceive to be moral or right. That's what laws do. Why do we have laws against murder? That's legislating morality. We're saying murder's wrong. We say rape's wrong, kidnap's wrong, robbery's wrong, sexual abuse is wrong, pedophilia is wrong. Name all the list of things that are wrong. Aren't those all moral issues? Those are morality issues. You can't enforce morality. Sure you can. That's what laws are for. I saw this guy, and he got life in prison for abusing his kid. I don't know if the kid ever died, or maybe he did. I don't remember what happened. I think he did. Otherwise, he wouldn't have got life. But this was just from child abuse and neglect. That's a moral issue. If you're a parent and you don't take care of your children, there's something wrong with you morally. You have a moral problem. And you can't legislate that, unfortunately. We cannot make parents moral. They may be very immoral. But there are laws to enforce that morality at some level. Laws like child support and all that sort of thing that are designed to enforce this morality. And so when people say you can't enforce morality, what they're saying is they don't want Christianity involved in their laws. They don't want real morals involved in their laws. That's what they're against. They don't want the church involved in any way, because we have a different set of morality than they do. We don't embrace the insanity that is in our world now of sex change operations and people that are just blasphemers of God. Their lifestyles are everything the Bible hates and that God's against. And yeah, no, it says it's not a fun place to live, frankly. We're every day, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Maranatha, get us out of here. But we have the opportunity to stand here and be the witness for the truth and hold to the apostolic doctrine in the face of, one, a cosmos that's insane, two, a religious cosmos that's insane. Modern Christendom is a joke in many ways. They're not getting the job done. In many cases, they won't even stand up for the truth. So we don't embrace any of that, and that's it. So Antiochus comes in. Now, this is, you may have heard of him. Antiochus IV is known as Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jews made fun of him because his name Epiphanes, I can't remember what it meant, a manifestation of God or something is the idea of it. An epiphany is a manifestation of deity. Antiochus, the manifestation of deity. Well, they had a play on words and they called him Epimenes, which means Antiochus the madman, Antiochus the insane. So they made a play on words with his name. So a brief Jewish rebellion, again, served to confirm his views. And so he outlawed these things. He defiled the temple in Jerusalem by erecting an altar to the god Zeus, allowing the sacrifice of pigs on the altar, and opening the temple to non-Jews. Well, this didn't set well, as you might imagine. And so it was clear that many Jews had been seduced by the virtues of Helen. Now, here's another problem that goes on during this time. You've got a divided populace. You got part of the Jews who are saying, you know, it's a new day. It's a new age. It's a new morale. It's a new normal. And we should go with the flow. These people aren't here to hurt us. We can let them have their gods and all of that. We can worship Yahweh beside him. And you can treat them all the same. Well, that wasn't what God said. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make graven images. Well, this is all the pagans did. Multiplied their gods and made pagan images to them. So, again, some of these people were seduced by this. They wanted it. Just as today, religious liberals want to embrace political liberalism. Because they want to embrace all this. Women in the ministry. Women as deacons. Women as pastors. Homosexuals in the ministry. They don't want to enforce morality within the church. They want everything to be the way the cosmos thinks it should be. Well, that's a big problem for us. Because we don't accept any of that. So the extreme measures adopted by Antiochus here. Helped unite the people who were opposed to being indoctrinated. And as with the truth in many cases, it's always in the minority. We are largely in the minority, not in just the world, but in this country specifically. But in the world in general, we're in the minority. The truth takes a back seat to almost everything nowadays. And people are happy with that, unfortunately. Well, when a Greek official tried to force a priest named Mattathias to make a sacrifice to a pagan god, he refused. And Josephus records the events, and I thought just reading this here was probably the best way to communicate all this, to just get the story from his mouth. This part is, as far as I can tell, perfectly historically accurate. He's not modifying his things here to try to please somebody. Because number one, he's writing about something that was, you know, 150, 200 years, 200 years in the past. He's not trying to impress them with the history. Now, at this time, there was one whose name was Mattathias, who dwelt at Modin, the son of John, the son of Simeon, the son of Osmaneus, a priest of the order of Joarib, and a citizen of Jerusalem. He had five sons, John, who was called Gaddis, and Simon, who was called Matthias, and Judas, who was called Maccabeus. You may have heard of Judas Maccabeus. And Eleazar, who was called Auron, and Jonathan, who was called Apphus. Now this Mattathias lamented to his children the sad state of their affairs and the ravage made in the city and the plundering of the temple and the calamities the multitude were under. And he told them that it was better for them to die for the laws of their country than to live so ingloriously as they did. Some people would prefer martyrdom to compromise. Probably not that many people like that now in the world, but there were. And some people are still that way. But when those who were appointed by the king came to Modin, they might compel the Jews to do what they were commanded and to enjoin those who were there to offer sacrifice as the king had commanded. And they desired that Mattathias, a person of the greatest character among them, both on other accounts and particularly on account of such a numerous and so deserving a family of children, would begin the sacrifice because his fellow citizens would follow his example. And that such a procedure would make him honored by the king. But Mattathias said he would not do it. And that if all the other nations would obey the commands of Antiochus, either out of fear or to please him, yet would not he nor his sons leave the religious worship of their country. But as soon as he had ended his speech, there came one of the Jews in the midst of them, and he sacrificed, as Antiochus had commanded. At which Mattathias had great indignation and ran upon him violently with his sons, who had swords with them, and slew both the man himself who sacrificed and Apelles, the king's general. Now you've killed one of the king's general. You got problems. You could kill that recalcitrant Jew you didn't like. That would still probably have created some problems. But now you've attacked a standing king. So he attacked them who had compelled the sacrifice with a few of his soldiers. He also overthrew the idol temple and cried out, "If anyone be zealous for the laws of this country and for the worship of God, let him follow me." And when he had said this, he made haste into the desert with his sons and left all his substance in the village. And that's recorded in Antiquities. That's, believe it or not, three verses in that book. 268 through 271. And that's probably enough for today. We'll look some more at these people and the history of all of this. But we'll go ahead and stop there. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to socialize with other believers, to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.